This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, Airbus buys out Bombardier, the Gulfstream G700 makes its maiden flight, Airbus is testing a blended wing-body aircraft, Boeing gets a 30-aircraft LOI for the passenger 747-8, Delta Airlines says they'll spend $1 billion to become carbon neutral. A Canadian aviation museum seeks to appeal to people who aren't av geeks. The risks of turning off your ADS-B transponder, and the U.S. might block the sale of the Leap 1C engine to China. Want more? We have a great positive airline story of the week, an emergency AD for the Cirrus Vision Jet, the Girls Go Fly organization, a Harrier jump jet for sale, a really good sonic boom story, the oldest continuously operating military base in the world, and finally, an addendum to last week's baseball toss on a moving train scenario. Einstein would be proud, perhaps. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 591 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian.
Hello, everyone. Greetings from Pennsylvania. Hopefully everyone's good. We had a warm spring, 55-degree day today. Very beautiful President's Day. I did Rob Mark a favor, and I signed his petition about Milwaukee, but he'll talk about that later. And I did some preparation for my event on the American Helicopter Museum with the Tuskegee Airmen, which will be this Sunday coming up. And one last thing, I want to thank Bill for stopping in on Saturday. It's great when somebody walks in and asks if there's an Airplane Geeks discount at my museum. I kind of like that. So thanks, Bill, for stopping in. I'm glad you had a good time, and it was great having a conversation. So, but looking forward to a good news pack show.
Boy, do we have a lot of news, and to help us with that is I'm not going to say the other Max anymore. I'm trying real hard. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast. He's the CFI of the year, and he's also an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Hey, and I'm here 2 weeks in a row.
Yes,
yeah, we were talking in the pre-show here about how much I've been flying lately, but this was a great weekend just to kind of recharge my batteries and come home and, you know, just enjoy the weekend a little bit. So that's good. And I don't know if you've noticed here, I've got a different name assigned for myself here on the screen. You see that?
I see that. Supermax.
That's right. That was the DJ name that I used one summer when I was working at a country Western radio station in Northern Pennsylvania.
So, really?
Yep, indeed.
Did that impress the ladies?
I don't think so, but I didn't care.
Okay. Also with us is Rob Mark, senior editor of Flying Magazine, publisher of the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, hi there. It's really nice. I've been gone for a few years,
yeah,
months, weeks, I don't know. I like the way you guys have kind of cleaned it up here. It certainly sounds better, and it's really nice to hang out with you guys. And as usual, I can tell when you ask. I mean, I know for certain there isn't a real guest, but I don't mind being, you know, like your eighth choice. It's pretty cool.
We're happy to have you, Rob. We're more than glad that you're with us. But we do have a ton of news this episode, lots and lots of things to go over, lots of interesting topics. So, guys, I think we better jump right into it so we can tackle this list. Is everybody ready?
Do you still have the same cool music?
Well, you have to say if you're ready first.
Oh, okay. I'm ready.
And I'm ready from the West.
I'm singing, I'm ready. Bum, 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 bum.
Well, our first story this episode, I don't know why it's not playing. First story comes from Forbes. Airbus buys Bombardier out of commercial aviation for $591 million. So this is by Marissa Garcia, one of my favorite aviation journalists. And with this deal, Bombardier has fully exited the
C-Series / A220 program. Now, I think everyone knows that Airbus took 50.01% ownership of the program in 2017. But now with this deal, Bombardier gets $591 million with $531 million of those dollars paid at closing. And then the balance, the remaining $60 million is to be paid in installments through 2021. Bombardier says with this deal, they avoid a roughly $700 million payment that it would have to make to fund production expansion. So I think that's some serious motivation to sell the rest to Airbus. Kind of an end of an era, I guess.
Oof, absolutely it is. But it gets better because today, too, they announced that they're not getting rid of their business aviation division, and that they've decided to sell their rail meaning cars with steel wheels that travel on the ground. But so it's been pretty volatile for the Bombardier employees. I'll bet you they're probably breathing somewhat easier. I'll bet they don't breathe completely easier until this is all closed. But it's a good place to start.
I was kind of surprised on the move to sell the rail part of the business and keep the business aviation part. I thought the plan was going to be just the opposite, but I don't know. Maybe I'm the only one that got surprised by that.
Well, it is kind of odd because they had already sold several other portions of their aviation business, so it kind of looked like they were getting out of that. So you're right. This does seem like a reversal of sorts.
Okay, but you guys don't understand Bombardier. You really don't.
All right, David, tell us. Tell us about Bombardier.
It's all about the snowmobile.
No. I think he's right.
I mean, nothing else matters to Bombardier but their Canadian snowmobiles. I mean, I think we should recognize that there's nothing more important to Canadians than maybe snowmobiles and snow and whatever that sport is where they brush the puck down the ice.
And all letters can be sent directly to David.
Yeah, I know.
At theairplanegeeks.com.
All the Canadians.
Our Canadian listeners may not be happy, but to hear about this.
The problem with Bombardier was they ended up diversifying way, way too much. And I joke about the snowmobiles, but they do make snowmobiles and trains. And airplanes, and you can't have that sort of conglomeration of manufacturing and keep it together for any length of time. I mean, without government subsidy. So I mean, I jest a little bit, but there's some truth in jest that, you know, they might actually eventually only be down to snowmobiles, even though I believe the rail division was still profitable. That's what I don't understand.
Well, they did.
I guess it was a matter of choosing. I mean, because they owe some serious money to the financial institutions up there. Although I don't know that they're all in Canada, but I'm sure most of them are. But I think I saw something today that when the rail sector deal closes, they're going to get something like $6 billion or something to put up against the $9 billion that they owe. So to them, it was, again, I don't know that they would have gotten that kind of money for the BizAv side.
Yeah,
because the only one that would probably want it is Textron.
Well, funny you should mention that, David. I was just going to bring up, I agree with your comments about conglomerates getting into too many different businesses. So I brought up the Textron homepage just to see what other kinds of businesses they have besides aviation. And they make the Cushman vehicles. They make EasyGo golf carts. They make Arctic Cat snowmobiles. They've got Jacobson specialized turf care vehicles for cutting grass. And the list goes on and on and on. So it is kind of an interesting parallel that, Textron has a kind of a similarly diverse group of products, and they are a leader in the aviation industry. That being said, I don't know how well they are doing. I'm sure it probably varies by business unit, but it's kind of interesting.
I mean, I have a helicopter in my restoration facility that was built by Kelvinator, the washing machine company. Okay. So I get diversification, but
it does your laundry for you as well, right?
The spin cycle is really kind of interesting.
Is that what they mean by spins? Okay. Yeah. Now I know.
Okay.
So the rail part of the business for Bombardier had not been doing well, actually. Bombardier reported a $1.6 billion loss for the full year, and they associated that with problems with its rail division. But now Airbus owns 75% of what's called Airbus Canada. The government of Quebec has the other 25%. But Airbus has the ability to redeem the remaining government stake by 2026. And I'm guessing the government of Quebec would probably just as soon get out of that. I really don't think they wanted to sink any more money into Bombardier, so that kind of forces them to take these drastic actions, Bombardier, and sort of retrench. But Airbus paints the picture that they've been doing pretty well with the A220. They say that their net orders for that aircraft have increased by just under 2/3 from when they first acquired the program. Net orders for the C-series/A220s are at 658 aircraft. That's as of the end of January. So that's pretty significant. Only 107 A220s are in service right now, seven airlines. We just had the Singapore Air Show disclosed, and Airbus there announced it signed an MOU with Green Africa Airways for 50 A220s. So that's a nice little buy there. So we'll see what happens with Bombardier going forward. I guess I can't imagine we'll see too many more big deals like this. They have their foundation now that they need to build on.
Well, there is the deal with between Boeing and Embraer, which has not closed.
That's waiting EU approval, right? EU antitrust approval, I think.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it is. I think that's where it's at. But that's another interesting play there. All right, well, let's move on to Gulfstream news. All new Gulfstream G700 makes first flight. It was a 2-hour, 32-minute maiden flight. They say they operated it on a 30-70 blend of sustainable aviation fuel. So, Rob, the G700 was just introduced late last year, wasn't it?
Yes, it was introduced at the NBAA show in Las Vegas to it was a gala unveiling. I mean, with probably 1,000 people in the audience and 50-foot video screens and smoke coming in from the sides and spotlights zigzagging all over the place and music that sounded like a herd of elephants were coming. So they spent a couple of bucks on that. But we knew that they were into the process, but I don't think I realized they were quite ready for their first flight yet. So it kind of surprised me the other day, but good on them. I mean, it's a cool airplane. If you like huge $73 million business jets, carries up to 19, and it's pretty neat.
But is there really a market for that right now?
Apparently there is. Gulfstream and the Bombardier Global 7500 are both very similar. The new Gulfstream is a little bigger than the Global, and Dassault is rumored to be working on a new large cabin airplane as well to compete with those two. I mean, if the airplane sells for $75 million or $72 million, you can imagine what the development costs alone must be these days. But again, I wouldn't have thought that there was enough of a market because business aviation's been slow. But they're that's pretty cool. Max is pointing to something. See, I never used to be able to see that. Now I can see he's trying to make a point, or he's pushing his glasses up off his nose. That's like this. This is I did this to somebody the other day by mistake, and I was pushing my glasses up, and they
with
were
his middle bad. Finger yeah. For those who cannot see what he's doing.
Oh boy! never give these two a new toy to play with.
Hey, so what I want to mention is I got to walk through the full size mock-up of the G700 last week.
You did.
When I was at Monterey. Oh. This thing is amazing. The salesperson, Kirsten Kruger, took me through it. Spent a lot of time with me. They were there because of the AT&T Open golf tournament, and there was just dozens and dozens of jets there. So that was really made a lot of sense for them to come by and show a couple of their planes off, including the mock-up. But it was amazing. What I noticed first off when I walked up into it is that I could stand up without bending over at all. I'm a little over 6 feet tall. It looked to me like probably someone 6'2" could, you know, walk up and down the aisles.
Climbed
into the cockpit, and they've got four really large displays, probably at least 14-inch displays, and those are controlled through five different touchscreen controllers. This is their Symmetry Avionics, which is powered by Honeywell, and they also had two full heads-up HUD displays, one for the pilot and one for the co-pilot, and those could display both kind of wireframe terrain, which I guess they call SVS, and then they've also got the infrared capability as well.
Enhanced vision.
Yep, EHS. And then walking back through it, there was a crew rest area because, you know, for these long trips, you're going to have switch out crew members. Behind that was a kitchen with two ovens, a refrigerator, a sink, and, you know, a lot of bar kinds of stuff, glasses and storage area and so on. Behind that was a large cabin where most of the people would sit. There was a large couch, which was along one side, and then at least a dozen, you know, comfy chairs throughout there. Behind that was the owner's quarters, which had, of course, the bed and
shower.
That's in the back, and that's optional, by the way. But I can imagine anybody who's going to spend $75 million is going to spend the extra however many dollars to get the shower as well. And behind that, there was a really large baggage door, kind of on the size of what you'd see on the Pilatus PC-12 and the PC-24s. So they can move a lot of, you know, large pieces of, you know, cargo into this airplane if they choose to. And of course, it's going to depend totally on the configuration. So I was pretty impressed with what Gulfstream has done. And by the way, I should mention, Gulfstream, of course, is a General Dynamics company, which is also a conglomerate, which has a huge number of business as well, which include the Marine Systems, the Electric Boat Division, the Bath Iron Works, European Combat Systems, Land Systems. It looks like a tracked vehicle of some kind. So, you know, it's really amazing. A lot of these companies are conglomerates that are into everything.
Hmm. Well, of course,
I don't think a single company can really handle a project like this anymore. As I said, I don't know the exact dollar figures for development of the G700, but again, if it's retailing at $72 or $73 million, what does that make development? It's probably close to $1 billion or something like that.
Oh, sure. I would think so.
Well, plus they could leverage some of their other, you know, prior aircraft. Now, Avweb said that they're on track to deliver these aircraft in 2022 under what they call an aggressive development campaign, which they note is pretty remarkable since it was just announced at NBAA last October. But they say since then they've completed five test articles, which are being used for various things, including the one that flew and load testing and things like that.
I'm surprised anybody these days would admit to an aggressive timetable. Mm. I mean, given what has happened to everyone else, but and of course,
especially with what Boeing just went through.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. Yeah.
What it's going through.
Well, the other tidbit I heard was that their first 2.5 years of production is already sold out, So we were talking before about
that question.
Exactly. So, you know, my observation has been in general, the business market, it seems like the high end seems to be less, impacted by economics. Folks at the very, very high end still have money when times are not good.
The G700 is powered by Rolls-Royce, as was the 650 and the 550 and most of these. They call it the Pearl 700, which is developed exclusively by Rolls-Royce, they say, for the Gulfstream G700. I don't know when they switched from the BR700 series to calling it the Pearl, but apparently Rolls-Royce likes Pearl because it's a registered trademark.
I think I remember talking to them about this, and if I'm not mistaken, I think the Pearl's a new engine. It's based on an earlier technology that Rolls-Royce has been working on for other motors, but I believe the G700's the first one to have this Pearl series of engines.
Yeah, there was the Pearl 15 that was planned for the Bombardier Global Express 5500, 6500. But this is the Pearl 700. But they're looking at a 5% specific fuel consumption reduction. And it's a more powerful engine than the previous 8% increase in takeoff thrust. That's compared to the BR725, which powers the G650.
And we didn't talk about some of the specs, I don't think. The G700 will go up to 7,500 nautical miles, can cruise up to 0.925 Mach. Now, it can't do both of those simultaneously. My recollection, and I could be off slightly on this, but my recollection is to get the 7,500 nautical miles, you'd have to be doing about Mach 0.8, which is still pretty respectable. And at Mach 0.925, I think then your range comes down to 6,500 nautical miles. But still, clearly, an aircraft with global kinds of capabilities and range.
Yeah, for sure. All right, let's move on to something else that's new. This is from Airbus. CNN reports Airbus reveals futuristic blended wing aircraft design. So I guess while nobody was watching, Airbus has been flying a small-scale remote-controlled blended wing-body demonstrator. And they showed the model at the Singapore Air Show, 2 meters long. It's called Maverick, which, like most of these kind of acronyms, you think of the acronym first and then find the words that fit. So the Maverick stands for the Model Aircraft for Validation and Experimentation of Robust Innovative Controls.
And that was probably because NASA's got blended wing body trademarked.
Well, the Maverick project was apparently launched in 2017. They began testing last year, June 2019. They say there's no specific timeline for entry into service. I think this is Airbus kind of exploring the concept. We've seen Boeing do that in the past.
It's probably the most efficient airframe ever, and it's only been around since the 20s.
Forever, yeah.
It's a flying wing, folks. If anybody doesn't know what a blended wing body is, it's a flying wing where the fuselage, you know, the problem is, I think maybe we've come over the hurdle, with the exception of David Vanderhoof, of people not caring about windows. If you don't care about windows, a blended wing body as a transport is a really good idea. It's highly fuel efficient, it's long ranged, and it can fit lots and lots of people. But those people won't ever have windows because they'll be inside the fuselage, and the wing really isn't designed to have windows in it. Now, if you're like me, and we all know what I say when I'm on an airliner is the best in-flight entertainment is looking out the window, I'm not sure I would be happy, but maybe flying in a flying wing won't be so bad.
Well, one solution you hear to that issue that some people propose is that because you can't have windows, instead that you mount displays and, in effect, show people what they would be seeing if it really was a window. But yeah, on fuel consumption, Airbus says that this could this design could cut fuel consumption up to 20%, which, of course, is pretty significant. But there's a video that we'll put in the show notes, and it's actually pretty interesting because it shows not only the model that they've been flying, and it shows that in flight, but then there's also some animations of what a future commercial aircraft might look like, including from the inside. So you get a peek, although it kind of flashes pretty quickly, a peek at what Airbus might be thinking about for the interior. All right, then on to Boeing. While we're talking about Airbus, EIN press wire, Boeing gets LOI for 30 747-8 passenger jets, a deal worth over $10 billion. Now, this is a letter of intent from Avatar Airlines for 30 of these. Boeing hasn't been selling any 747-8s except for the freighter version. Passenger version, it hasn't been a success in the marketplace. Like, it's gone kind of nowhere. So 30 of them, if it happens, would be a real shot in the arm and keep the 747 line going.
I think you hit on it, if it happens. I mean, if this were from some carrier, even in the Far East or somewhere else that people had heard of before, rather than a brand new airline that said, I know what we want. We want a big four engine airplane to carry all our passengers. And even though most of the rest of the world has said, you know what, they just don't work out in the end because they suck too much gas. From an airline that doesn't even fly yet. So we'll see, but I think I would be guarded. I wouldn't cash that check yet.
I think it's a perfect idea. If you think about the current environment, 747 combos or cargo carrying 747s that you can put highly contagious passengers in seem to be on mark for the current environment.
The plan with this is for an aircraft with 539 economy seats in lower deck and then 42 business seats in the upper deck. And Avatar plans to launch ultra low fare scheduled service to city pairs throughout the United States and Hawaii, starting with some old 747-400s, 14 of them. Where would they get those? There's a lot of those in storage. So that's not a problem. There's a video for investors because Avatar Airlines is offering a private equity offering of Series A convertible preferred stock offered at $15 a share with a minimum purchase of 5,000 shares. So if you've got a spare $75,000 laying around and you want to take a risk, have at it. But when I was watching this video, I see Barry Michaels is the founder and CEO of Avatar. Now, Rob, sometimes, you know, what's old is new again.
Where do I know that name from, Barry Michaels?
Well, it started out, if you go back into the 90s, with Family Airlines. Family Airlines said it would offer $249 fares from L.A. to New York City using Boeing 747-100s and 200s back then. And he was behind that. But there were a whole lot of lawsuits. In 1996, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, filed a suit against Barry Michaels and his wife for fraudulently offering unregistered stock for the airline. And they ended up having to return $363,000 to investors, and they had to pay $181,000 civil penalty, each of them. But then in 2008, Family Airlines filed a new application with the Department of Transportation, with Michaels as CEO. And they were going to use up to 12 Boeing 747-400 aircraft in a 581-seat configuration. And the DOT declined that application. And then we get to Avatar Airlines. In 2010, there was an application under that name, Avatar Airlines. but that application didn't proceed. And then in 2014, Avatar launched another application with the Department of Transportation. Now, it didn't list Michaels in a management position, unlike previously, but reportedly, when he met with airport officials, he represented himself as the chairman of the airline. So this guy's been around. He's been around for a while. He's got a penchant for 747s and low cost. So I don't know if he's even going to get a ticket to fly.
Do you get a fetish? Can you fetish on an airplane? I mean, it seems like a 747 fetish, you know? It's like,
well, I mean, if you had to, that would be the perfect one, right? I mean, who doesn't love the 747? Oh, I know. Yeah. I'm crazy about it. So
I like the 747, except the new ones that are going into the United States Air Force in ugly red, white, and blue color that was picked by someone. But I'm going to start a thing to keep the color scheme for Air Force One to be an iconic scheme and not Magna red.
Well, these are for delivery into the future, right, David? Like well into the future? And
well, yeah, there's still plenty of the current president will not get the current president, even if he gets four more years, will not get these aircraft.
All right. And so I would think that, you know, painting the aircraft comes pretty late in the process of building it. So whoever's around at the time could probably revise that somewhat.
Yeah, but think about the name. I mean, Avatar. I mean, it's a representation of something
that's not real.
What you're seeing is not what's really there. I don't know if I would have chosen Avatar Airlines, but that's just me.
Yeah. So these articles that are just, you know, raving about the 747 may not be dead yet, I think they should, look into, do a little research and look into the people involved.
Well, let's wish them luck because, frankly, I hope they are wildly successful. I'm very, very serious about that. I think it would be totally cool if they would, you know, be able to stand this airline up and be able to bring 747 service back, because what a fantastic airplane.
Yeah. In that video presentation, it says everyday fares as low as $19. Fly anywhere in the U.S. for under $99. And then they have this concept, and we've heard this before, too, and this is not a criticism, but it's the Fly Free Club, for which there's planned to be a $49 registration fee and then $249 a year that allows you to, and it's in quotes, fly free on any available flight.
But luggage will be $450 per bag and carry on.
Yeah, you're probably right.
All right, let's talk about Delta Airlines. Delta commits $1 billion to curb its carbon emissions. Delta says they want to be the world's first carbon neutral airline. And they say that to do that, starting on March 1st of this year, 2020, they'll commit $1 billion over the next 10 years. Now, how are they going to do that? So the Delta says that they're going to focus on three things to become carbon neutral. Carbon reduction, and that's to decrease the use of jet fuel and increase efficiency. Carbon removal, which is investing in innovative projects and technology opportunities that could include things like forestry and wetland restoration, grassland conservation, some other things like that. And then the third is stakeholder engagement, building coalitions with groups to advance carbon reduction and removal goals. But they do say that this doesn't mean that they're going to give up on fossil fuel.
I don't think they have any choice. I mean, they can't give up on fossil fuel yet. It's, you know, sustainable fuel is great. It's a step in the right direction, but it's not ready for prime time yet. So, you have to admire the fact that it's like what we were just talking about with the airline. At least they're trying. And I can't imagine, though. Maybe you guys have a different opinion, but I mean, in this corporate world, who tend to be people that lean toward a particular political direction, it can't be easy to take a stand on something that so many other people have said it's all baloney. So it's pretty bold.
Well, and we've talked about flight shaming recently, and this, I think, kind of fits within that. You know, part of the objections to airlines and the part of the, you know, basis for the flight shaming movement is, you know, the carbon emissions. So I think this is a good way to kind of show that at least one airline is doing something about that, and hopefully won't, you know, be hurt broadly by flight shaming movement. I was talking with someone last night, a doctor who just came back from spending 15 months in, let's see, New Zealand. And when she bought her flight to San Francisco, she paid the extra dollars for carbon offsets. So I guess with some airlines, you can actually choose to, you know, contribute individually to this, you know, this problem. But obviously the airline is taking it one step further and saying that they're going to do it, you know, for all their passengers.
Did she tell you how much it was?
You know, I asked, and she said it was low dollars. So it was, it, in her mind, it was insignificant compared to the cost of the ticket.
Hmm. Now, Patrick Wiggins sent us a link to an article written by Michael Bernard in Clean Technica. Headline is, Delta Airlines' claim of becoming carbon neutral in March is disingenuous at best.
And at worst?
Yeah. Continuing my theme here of trying to do a little bit of background research on some of these people making some of these statements and things, Michael Bernard is chief strategist with TFIE Strategy, Inc. That TFIE stands for The Future is Electric. Now, but he's got some criticisms. Primarily, Delta's CEO, Ed Bastian, was on CNBC and said the company's going fully carbon neutral starting March. The author of this piece here seemed to assume that what he meant was that beginning in March, Delta would be carbon neutral, which, of course, is not anywhere close to the case. The $1 billion over 10 years is just that, 10 years. But he also is critical of the amount. And he says, while $1 billion sounds like a lot of money, it's over 10 years, and when you look at Delta's annual revenue, they're talking about spending 0.2% of their annual revenue, which he says that doesn't sound so impressive, does it? He also doesn't like the fact that Bastian said, we will continue to use jet fuel. This is you know, clearly someone whose, you know, view of a future of a carbon-neutral airline is one that doesn't use jet fuel. So it's a counterpoint, and I think maybe the reality lies somewhere in between. I think Delta is trying to, and I don't blame them, but I think they're trying to portray this as something seriously positive. This other guy is saying, yeah, well, not so much. Like I say, I think it may be somewhere in the middle.
Well, somebody's got to do something. You know, if you believe in the cause, I mean— which a lot of corporations do, actually, you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah, I agree completely. Yeah, yeah. Hey, we heard from our friend Brian Coleman, and he popped a story.
I remember Brian.
You remember Brian? Yes.
Yeah.
He popped in a CNN story. This is a Brian story for sure. I mean, I like it, but it's definitely a— this is the Aviation Museum for People Who Don't Care About Aviation. That's pretty—
that's a good title. Does make you wonder.
It does make you wonder. Now, in the article, they say, you know, if you're not an av geek— they don't use the term av geek, but if you're not an av geek, aviation museums can be boring. And you think about it, yeah, I mean, most of the people that like aviation museums— now, Dave is about ready to say something here.
I'm going to— never mind. I'm going to keep my— I'm going—
all
to
right,
keep—
well, you can—
my
chime
industry,
in.
My mouth shut about this in my industry, but go ahead.
So the Canada National Aviation and Space Museum is in Ottawa.
And a good museum at that.
And yeah, I have been to Ottawa a couple of times, but not in about 10 or 14 years. No, I know when the last time I was in Ottawa. It was on 9/11, actually. But that's another story. They aim, quote, to spark interest in those who don't think they care about planes, especially, but not exclusively, women who often don't feel like aviation museums are a place for them. So how are they going to do this? Well, The curator is Erin Gregory, and she says that they tell stories about the people who are associated with the exhibits, and they want visitors to hear stories about people who are like them. So I think that's great. She says, one of my goals as a curator is to feminize the collection and to try to have the floor be much more representative of all the people who fly, including women. I'm working to revise and to revamp the museum to make it as inclusive as possible.
That means the place should have more than one sink. Every place we go, we've got to have two sinks. And God help us if my daughter is staying somewhere, because then we have two women, one man, and maybe two sinks, and it's chaotic.
Is there any group we haven't offended yet in this show? That's what I want to
know. I don't think so. There are still plenty. Wait till we start talking about polar bears.
Stop.
I mean.
Yeah, stop right there.
Okay. And guys, all the listeners out there, if you guys have something, a problem with something I said, don't beat these guys up, because they only drafted me at the last minute, so they don't have to have me back.
Go ahead, David.
But to go back to the subject, I actually feel for we're in the process of revamping our museum and add more cultural aspects to it. One of the items is from the Whirly Girls, is the original first 100 Whirly Girls. We have their quilt. Sorry, Binet. Their quilt with all of their names on it. And we're about to try to reinvent that area where we talk about women in helicopter flight. Especially aviation museums are technical. It's not just about the machinery, or the engine that propels a Bell 47. It's about the people who designed it. I think we've had a bit of a revolution, with the last couple of years, with things like Hidden Figures, where we've talked about the women in NASA, and trying to bring out those stories as more, to make them more inclusive. I love it when a little girl comes in the store and says, I want to be a helicopter pilot, or I want to be a pilot. And you can show her things and her eyes light up. And our girls in science and technology, where they are interacting with the technology, and the women who are now doing that full time for their careers. It's a tough subject, but most museums are going through a whole revisiting their catalog and their artifacts to see how they can make it representational to more aspects than just pilots and us av geek nerds.
Yeah, that's good. I think it's a good realization. And if it gets more people interested, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I do too, actually, because I think that, we, for years, we never really, I don't think any of us really thought about, who's the actual audience for some of this stuff. People would normally say, well, anybody who's interested in helicopters and things. But when we think about the fact that there are lots of people out there who don't even know that they're interested in that yet.
Right.
And we just never thought like that before. So I think it's a good plan.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. We have an item from Plane and Pilot Magazine. Turn off your ADS-B, go to jail. So the FAA posted a national policy effective January 24th, 2020. And it deals with a lot of stuff, but in part with ADS-B transponders. Who put this story in?
I put the story in there. I think it's fascinating that you can get in big trouble for just turning off your ADS-B out transmissions. And I think most people probably aren't aware of that. And I think here's where the people kind of get confused. They will point to the fact that there are many portions of the airspace where ADS-B out is not required. And of course, if they have installed ADS-B out, it would be easy to think that, hey, I could get away with not turning it on in those portions of the airspace where it's not required. The FAA is saying, if you have put it in your aircraft, you need to keep it on all the time, same as for a transponder. And they have made it pretty clear as to how severe a violation they feel this is. They have updated order 2150. Oops, I just went away there. .3C. I guess this is probably the D version. I have the C version from last year up here. This year's list 30 different acts that can cause revocation. Last year's had 27. But just to kind of put this in context, turning off your ADS-B out is in the same list with things like cheating on any required test or flight check, refusing to submit to a drug or alcohol test, have a passenger carrying operations by a student pilot, which would be strictly illegal, aiming a laser beam so that it interferes with the operation of an aircraft. So the FAA is basically saying that this is something you just better not do, because they will, you know, put you at the kind of the top of the punishments list. They take this particular action very seriously, and I'm not sure that most pilots realize that.
So Launchpad Merzari threw in some thoughts. He pointed out that there's a group of Cub pilots in El Paso, Texas. They've been asking for an exemption. Now, the Cub, of course, doesn't have an electrical system, or at least the old ones didn't. Maybe none of them did. I don't know. I don't know Cubs that well. But some of them want to be able to put in a battery-powered ADS-B system in an aircraft that was not originally certificated with an electrical system. But, you know, if you have an ADS-B system in your airplane and you're in an area where ADS-B out's not required, this doesn't mean that you have to have your equipment turned on, does it?
It does. It absolutely means that.
So if you have it, it has to be on.
Yes, and that's the problem for these owners in El Paso. There was a story in, AOPA back in December about a group of co-owners of a Luscombe. So I think that's what he's thinking of, is this group of several people that own a Luscombe. That aircraft has a transponder in it, and they have a battery, just sufficient power to run that transponder. And I think what they do for there is that they turn it on to exit the Class Charlie that the aircraft is based on, and then turn it back on when they're coming back in. So I guess that is legal. And they're searching for an exemption that would allow them to do the same thing with ADS-B out. But current rules of ADS-B out do not allow you to turn off an ADS-B out transponder.
Hmm. And do you know what the objection is? Is it a privacy thing, or?
I think that perhaps there's some feeling that either, people might be trying to avoid detection, or, you know, I don't know why it's required to be on all the time. Certainly it enhances safety to have it on all the time in all airspace. So that may be the reason. Hmm.
Is this true that there's an anonymous mode for ADS-B out? Something that so that the flight tracking services won't pick it up, but the FAA can still see it.
Yes, the aircraft can still be seen, but it doesn't identify who that aircraft is.
Ah, okay. All right. Well, we'll have some information in the show notes. In fact, we'll put a link to that national policy that's effective, that already is effective. And if you want to see the relevant parts, the page 9-13. Talks about the single acts of misconduct generally warranting revocation. And then that references a figure 9-5, which lists those 30 single acts that Max T was describing. And the one that's applicable here is the 30th, operating an aircraft without activated transponder or ADS-B out transmission. All right. Next up, engines in China. This is an item from Reuters. U.S. weighs blocking GE engine sales for China's new airplane. Well, the airplane is the C919, the COMAC. In order to export certain technologies to China and some other countries, you need an export license from the U.S. Commerce Department. Now, the Chinese COMAC C919, that's the aircraft, it's still not certified, but sort of a 737/A320 class aircraft. It uses LEAP-1C engines, that are produced by CFM International, which, of course, is a joint venture between General Electric and the French company Safran. So there are reports that the U.S. government is considering denying GE's latest license request, which would block those exports. Now, as CNN reports it, nobody is responding to requests for information. No one's talking about this. And there's also the possibility that some flight control systems are also being mentioned. And Reuters says at the heart of the debate over a possible crackdown on the sale of U.S. parts to China's nascent aircraft industry is whether such shipments would fuel the rise of a serious competitor to U.S.-based Boeing company or boost China's military capabilities. Well, I think as far as the rise of a serious competitor to U.S.-based, I think that horse is already out of the barn. I mean,
yeah, I was saying, isn't there already one? I was trying to remember. Serious competitor to Boeing, isn't there one out there?
Airbus.
Yeah, of course.
Which, of course, uses the LEAP 1A engine, which is very, very close to this for the COMAC. It uses that on the A320 family. And the LEAP 1B, which is also very, very similar to these other two, is used on the Boeing 737. So China's already got these engines, basically. So, you know, fears of reverse engineering or, you know, this is going to hurt, you know, Boeing. I think those things are already in motion, I think.
Well, and realistically, both China and Japan are going to have large airplane programs, you know, in the future. And yeah, this might slow it down ever so slightly, but it doesn't change the fact that they're, you know, set on having their own source of airliners.
I think this is a PR campaign by the Chinese to gather some publicity for the 919, because it's kind of becoming the C-series of the Far East.
The internal demand in China for, you know, a single aisle aircraft is just enormous. And China would love to be able to produce their own instead of having to buy them from Boeing and Airbus. But the C919 is their first attempt to do that. But, you know, we had Richard Abulafia on last time, and he explained some of the problems that COMAC has with pulling this off, some sort of structural issues with them wanting to own the technology and the IP as opposed to being an integrator of other systems. They're not anywhere close to that with jet engines, which is why they've bought or are buying the CFM engine for the C919. I mean, they'd like nothing better than to be able to produce an engine themselves for that aircraft. But, yeah, like I say, they're not even close. But, you know, you talk about reverse engineering. There's already maintenance taking place with joint ventures in China. You know, they already have access to the engines. They're already flying them. So I don't know if this is just part of a larger U.S. strategy here or what. All right. We've been having a number of positive airline stories of the week.
We have?
Yeah, we've been having a lot of these lately, Rob. It's been kind of amazing. And we have another one here.
And this is no surprise, another Southwest story.
Yeah, most are Southwest. But we do have a good United story now and then. So what happened here with this Southwest flight? This is pretty exciting, Max.
Yeah, so basically there was a flight from Colorado to California, and a flight attendant realized that baby needed a diaper change. A flight attendant named Jenny brought the couple back to a space where they could change the diaper on their newborn, and she complimented them on their daughter and asked what had prompted a flight with such a young infant, just 8 days old. They gave them their shortened adoption story, and so they had flown out to Colorado to adopt this baby, and a few minutes later, flight attendant went on the intercom and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, there's a very special guest on the flight today. She's only 8 days old, and she's traveling home with her mom and dad." And the flight attendants announced they'd be passing out napkins and pens for anyone who wanted to jot down a message for the new parents. Of course, the cabin erupted into cheers and applause. Yeah, a steady stream of people went by to look at the baby and congratulate the couple. And, you know, there are a lot of poignant comments here. One of the best ones here was one of the napkins read, "I was adopted 64 years ago. Thank you for giving this child a loving family to be part of. Us adopted kids need a little extra love. Congratulations." Anyway, the crew collected all the napkins and read a few of them aloud. And altogether, they had more than 60 napkins, which they bundled together for the family, along with a set of pilot wings. I guess the airlines are always looking to recruit new pilots, so they're having to start really early these days. And anyway, so that's pretty much the story. And I think afterwards, someone put the book, put all the napkins together in a book for them so that they would always, you know, have them in great shape. And anyway, fun story.
Yeah. And I think it really, really moved the couple. They had been trying for many, many years to conceive without success. And so they went this adoption route, but they were, you know, kind of apprehensive about it. They were worried or wondering about what people would think and, you know, all of these kinds of fears and things that really, you know, aren't actually warranted, but are understandable. And so to have this plane load of strangers come up, you know, have this outpouring of support and love for this couple was just, I mean, just a huge, huge thing. So, great for the Southwest crew and attendants for pulling this off, making this happen in this way. It's just a really meaningful thing.
Right. And this new couple learned without a doubt that they will never travel on an airliner again without extra diapers.
Yeah.
You know what I like best about this story is it's unique. You know, we hear lots of good stories about things that happen on airlines. I have never heard one that was anything like this at all. So I think that really shows a fair amount of creativity on the standpoint of flight crew to have even come up with this idea. So great story.
Yeah, it is a good one. It is a good one. Launchpad Merzari threw this little item in here from AvWeb. FAA Emergency AD grounds Cirrus jet fleet. Something about a cabin fire and audio amplifiers.
Fake news, fake news. Never happened. No, I'm teasing, of course. Everyone knows that I'm a huge fan of the Vision Jet, and I just did the quick math here. I have, over the last 7 weeks, averaged about 20 hours a week in various Vision Jets, so I have been, you know, flying a storm up with them while trying to keep my my regular clients on my schedule, which has been very, very difficult.
So, Max, what you're telling us is that the Vision Jets, their amplifiers go up to 11.
Go up to instead 11.
Instead of 10. Okay, there's a movie reference he doesn't get. Do you ever watch Spinal Tap?
No, afraid not.
Oh, you need to watch Spinal Tap. their amplifiers, everybody else's amplifiers go to 10, but in Spinal Tap, their amplifiers go to 11.
I see. Well, hopefully they don't create a fire. So the you know, the backstory is that in late December there was a fire in a Cirrus Vision jet at Santa Monica, which occurred within a few minutes after the pilot started the engine and before he took off. We've talked about it before. He thought initially that his contact lenses were kind of getting foggy or something like that, but eventually he figured out there was some kind of light smoke in the cabin, got out, and there was a significant fire. There has been a team of, I've been told, 9 people working full-time at Cirrus to try and track down the source of the fire. There have been a couple service bulletins and ADs that have come out as they've gotten more and more information. And late last week, they came to the conclusion that these audio amplifiers, of which there are 12 scattered around the cabin, to feed the consumer headsets, you know, the 3.5 millimeter plugs, not the headsets that pilots use and to talk on the intercom, but the ones that are used for the in-flight entertainment system. They apparently determined that one of those was most likely the culprit. And so there was a service bulletin that came out on Friday, followed by an AD almost immediately after that. And between Friday and I think Thursday, they had already fixed virtually every aircraft in the fleet, even though it was an 8-hour labor to remove the interior, pull out these 12 audio amplifier PC boards. Now, I actually made a point of figuring out what they look like. I was at a service center where we had dropped a jet off to have this service bulletin done. And I was really quite surprised. The circuit boards are very small, probably about the length and width of a pack of cigarettes, but not much thicker than a quarter of an inch. And they're wrapped in what looks almost like a black shrink-wrapped tubing. Not the entire card, but most of it. And apparently this fire was in one of the very first copies of an aircraft to come off the production line. And for whatever reason, there may have been some moisture that got in there. And this is kind of a confined, trapped area. And ultimately, the thinking right now is that that may be what had led to the fire. So anyway, kudos to Cirrus for staying on top of this. And they had already communicated with every owner within 24 hours of figuring out that this appeared to be the culprit. And, immediately made arrangements to get the work done. Fleet size is probably, maybe 170 airplanes, maybe 180 scattered around the world. So fortunately, it's a small enough fleet that, it's easy to kind of get in touch with everybody and get everything fixed. So I think they are doing a great job of tackling problems, keeping communication going with customers and resolving them as quickly as possible. And, any new model has problems early in its life, but I think the real sign of, what company is doing well is how they deal with those problems. Cirrus, I think, has really set a fairly high standard for how they've been dealing with this problem.
And you have been listening to This Week in Cirrus History, brought to you by Max Trescott. We are not sponsored by Cirrus yet, but if we keep going, maybe we will be.
Well, do you have any counterpoint to offer?
how does Cirrus notify, or any company like that, notify all the owners? They just have a big email list or something? Is that how they do it?
A lot of them were personal phone calls. And I was with people who got calls impressive. Literally, I know one person who got a call from a vice president of sales, saying, hey, this is what we found out. So, it's kind of all hands on deck, operation to make sure that the communication is good. No, it's not just an email to people.
Well, of course, and you can do that when you have 100 airframes out there. I mean,
exactly.
If there were 5,000, let's say, bonanzas, it would be a little tougher.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Air Force Times. Air Force cuts pilot training goal in 2020. So I guess the original plan was for 1,480 pilots to be produced in the 2020 fiscal year. But now the Air Force now expects them to produce a little bit less, 1,300 pilots a year. That compares with 1,279 that were produced in 2019. The Air Force needs more pilots. So being behind the plan is probably not too good. I don't know, David, does it have a huge impact?
Well, if our current administration wants a bigger, badder Air Force with lots more fighter planes and bombers, the answer is this isn't a good sign. We're going to have aircraft that have no pilots. But I think this is just a reflection of the universe in general, because we talk about pilot shortage in the civilian world also. So it's a balance. We're not putting out as many pilots. We're overstrung in on force deployment. So, and we're not retaining as many pilots. So it's a struggle. I don't know what the Air Force is going to do to recruiting to try to get the levels back to where they want it to be.
And I must say, there's a rather cool picture with this story. Shows a pair of T-6 Texans in formation, and we're looking out past the pilot in one, out at the other one next to it with two people in it, tandem configuration, most likely an instructor pilot and a pilot trainee, and they're above the cloud deck over Laughlin Air Force Base in Texas. Great photo.
All right, what's up with the geeks? Max Trescott, let's start with you. You've always got something going on.
Indeed. I was just going to mention that last week on Aviation News Talk, went down in depth to talk about special VFR. And of course, there was a lot of aspects of the Kobe Bryant helicopter crash that involved special VFR. But it occurred to me that I had only ever used it a few times, literally just 2-3 times in my entire 40 plus years of flying. And I kind of surmised that that was probably the case for most pilots. So we talked about that in depth. Some of the feedback that came back was from helicopter pilots who said, hey, we use this all the time. And from pilots in Alaska who said, hey, we use this a lot. So outside of helicopter pilots and people flying in Alaska, most people seem to agree, yeah, they just didn't have a whole lot of experience with it. So that was, turned out to be a timely topic. This week, we're talking about wake turbulence because a few days ago, for the second time in my career, I encountered wake turbulence, which I have tried to avoid with a passion, but this time we got hit a little bit. So talk about wake turbulence accidents and what's that?
Did you get caught into a flat spin that was unrecoverable, crash in the Pacific, and lose your Rio?
Yes, and so we're also talking about what causes wake turbulence and how to avoid it as well.
You can't shake him, David.
No, he's unflappable. So Max, what were you in the wake of?
A Boeing 767 that was 6 miles ahead of us landing on a parallel runway at San Jose International.
Are 767s normal into San Jose?
Not unusual. I mean, I would say mostly it's 737s going into there.
So he must have been higher than you, huh?
Apparently so. We were right on the glide slope, so he must have been above the glide slope. And that's a key thing we're going to talk about is that for small airplanes, it pays to be above the glide slope when you're following a big aircraft. But, unfortunately, you look at the autopilots, they don't have a way of coupling to the glide slope, at some fixed distance above the glide slope. So if you're going to use the autopilot, the only choice is to be on the glide slope, unfortunately.
Oh, you said he was on a parallel runway, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Rob, have you had any experience with wake turbulence?
No, actually, I've been pretty lucky. I know people who have, and it scared the bejesus out of them when it hit because I know one guy I was just talking to when I was down at Fort Lauderdale a month or so ago. We were chatting about wake turbulence at lunch, and he said, I was in the left seat of a Learjet when it happened to me at about 1,000 feet AGL, and holy molies, it gets your attention real quick.
Yeah, in our case, we were probably about 2,000 feet above the ground, maybe a little lower, and the aircraft suddenly rolled about 45 degrees to the right with the autopilot on, and I can only imagine how far it would have gone if the autopilot hadn't been on to immediately resist it and start bringing us back wings level.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. All right, we'll look forward to that. Rob, what's going on in Chicago?
Well, we have an interesting situation going on for those people that remember Chicago as the place where the former Meigs Airport shut down in the middle of the night, or people out Max West's way where Santa Monica has been a big topic. One of our airports, the one I've been flying at for a good portion of my life, Chicago Executive Airport, is trying to shut down one of our runways. And it's the runway that essentially functions as our crosswind runway, northeast, southwest, because, boy, and when the wind is strong out of the northeast as it is in the wintertime or out of the southwest like it is in the summer, we're really glad we have that runway. But, of course, the airport board says, nah, we don't need that stupid thing. We're going to build hangars on it. And because we want more jets.
If we build hangars, they will come.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they've created a plan that's full of an awful lot of fluff, and I think they're hoping that the two towns that sponsor the airport are just going to do what one of the engineers suggested, which is don't get involved in all the details of the plan. Just take a look at the executive summary. It'll tell you everything you need to know. So a lot of the pilots have really not been going along with this very well. The Chicago Executive Pilots Association, of which I must admit I am the treasurer. I don't make the money. I just take it in. But we have been on a rampage trying to at least, well, actually we'd be happy if we could just get them to listen to us. The airport board Not surprising, I'll bet, to anyone who flies at some of the other airports that service airplanes that weigh less than 12,500. And the airport management tends to brush you off because you don't bring in the fuel flowage numbers that the Gulfstreams and the Falcons and that sort of thing do. So we've been arguing with the towns and the airport, and it's been quite an event. But the reason I'm mentioning all this is not, of course, the fact that it really sucks when people won't listen to anything you have to say, like you're all idiots. But we put a petition up on change.org, and I'll give you the link there, Max, later on. And if people want to go up and on change.org and take a look for the petition related to Chicago Executive Airport and sign it for us, that would be great. And if these are pilots who actually have flown into and out of the airport and are familiar with the runway, that would be 10 times better. We've already got seven. I forget. I think about 750 pilots that have already signed up, that have flown into and out of the airport, of the 2,200 or something, I believe, that have signed the petition just to say it's a stupid idea for any airport to lose one more runway to put up more hangars for jets. I think in our case, it particularly smacks because there's an awful lot of room on this airport that can be developed without taking this runway. But you know, again, when you've got airport management that doesn't want to listen, it's tough to fight them.
All right. Yeah. Be sure to send that link to me and we'll get that into the show notes. And you can find that at airplanegeeks.com/591. Be sure to look for it there. All right. Launchpad sent in a few items. He said he flew his Focke-Wulf into the brand new Lone Star Flight Museum in Houston. He's going to have some interviews and reports for us in the coming weeks. He also notes that Launchpad, he says he's attending B-24 ground school in Fort Worth, Texas. Jeez. And that's next weekend. Yeah, Launchpad does a lot of stuff with the Commemorative Air Force and, yeah, warbirds like that.
Boy, pilot shortage has gotten worse.
Yeah.
Even the B-24s need more pilots.
That's right. And then Launchpad also points out that at Sun and Fun, we're going to again do our live Airplane Geeks podcast from the porch of Sun and Fun Radio there. That's going to be April 1st at, as Launchpad says, 1800 hours. I always have to, you know, subtract in my head to figure that. So 6 o'clock or after the air show, and it's going to go until the night air show starts that night. So that'll be live on Sun and Fun Radio and also live on atclive.net.
Oh, wow. Are you going this year, Max and Max?
Yes.
And or David?
I'm going.
I'm not 100% sure yet, but
you're going.
I was going to say, Max, if you have any trouble converting, you know, 1800, just remember that 1800 in Navy time is 4 bells.
Yeah, that'll help.
Well, 4 bells and all is well.
That's right. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But then again, I'm the son of a sailor, so.
All right. Well, so, and you're going to be there, Rob, right?
Here again, Max.
Say that again.
I said, we'll see you at Sun Fun again this year.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're going to join us on the first, aren't you?
Launchpad said I had to.
Yeah, good. He's right. All right. So, we're expecting to do that. And then I think the following night, there's going to be a, same as last year, Launchpad organized this, sort of a revolving show with different aviation podcasters coming on, talking a little bit about, you know, what they do and some issues like that too. So we're looking forward to that as well. All right, shout out. We got a message from Girls Go Fly, and they're announcing their participation with Mattel and Barbie on this International Women's Day celebration. Now, the Girls Go Fly was founded by a woman, a pilot, when she discovered that only 6% of the pilots in the world are women. And even more astonishing, they say, is that this is the same percentage it was in 1929. So this movement was born from that. So young women are taken for free flights by a female pilot, helping to, you know, boost their imaginations, ignite the possibility of a career in aviation. And this came to the attention of Mattel through their Aviator Barbie initiative. I don't know if you guys know. I didn't before this, and I don't know why you would. But Mattel has, who produces Barbies, of course, has a number of Barbie aviators and, you know, sort of STEM-related kinds of Barbies, which is pretty cool. So they're looking to get the word out. Girls Go Fly is at girlsgofly.com. They're also on Facebook, Girls Go Fly, on Instagram. They're accepting sponsorships and donations, and they have a newsletter that you can sign up for on their website. And that International Women's Day, that's coming up March 8th this year, 2020. That website is internationalwomensday.com. Another item from Launchpad. He found in AvWeb, Airshow Harrier for sale. So this is a Sea Harrier that the current owner is selling. He bought a...
Art Nails.
Yeah, he bought a single-seat carrier version from the British Royal Navy. He has flown it at air shows since 2007. David, is he... I've seen the Harrier at... I'll think of which air show in a minute, but is he the only one flying the Harrier at U.S. air shows?
He's the only civilian Harrier pilot in the world. The Sea Harrier actually is based near me in Delaware. Art has actually the Sea Harrier. He also has a two-seat Harrier that he was in the process of restoring. But yeah, if you've seen, Max, I believe the Harrier was at one of the air shows we were together where you've seen it. He's flown up and down the East Coast. It's a Sea Harrier. It's a Char. And he puts on a really good demo. Art Nails was a Marine Corps Harrier pilot. And it's unfortunate we're not going to see it, but hopefully someone will pick it up. It's an expensive piece of kit to fly, and it takes some skill. But the Harrier demo still is one of the most impressive things you can see. I don't think the F-35B will ever replace the sound of water injected turbofans. It's definitely
deafening. Would that be the word you're struggling for, David?
Deafening is a good word for it, yes. But in a good way.
Okay, I guess I never thought of deafening as a good word, but
oh, it is when it comes from jet engines.
If you like jet noise, it's great.
Yeah, I enjoyed that show. Yeah, I remember. I think it was a show that you and I were both at. And yeah, I enjoyed it. It's the only time I'd seen a Harrier flying. And so that was, except in movies. So that was pretty good.
Let's hear it for Arnold and his Harrier piloting skills.
Yeah, I know. That's right.
In True
Lies.
What
I was thinking of. Yeah.
What was that movie? The Last
Something. It's True Lies.
The what?
The one where Arnold flies the Harrier, yeah. Is True Lies.
Oh, True Lies. Okay, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I like that too.
It's one of my favorite movies.
All right, on to some listener mail. Chris sent us a link to an article, which I just really enjoyed this. I think you all need to read this article. It's from...
Oh, I read it. Yeah.
It's great.
It is great. It's from Air and Space Mag. With a loud kaboom, an F-105 upstaged our Air Force graduation. And, you know, I was going to try to encapsulate this, but it's written so well that I just couldn't do justice to it. But it goes back into the 60s and a graduation at an Air Force academy. And there was a flyover by F-105.
Go ahead and read it. Go ahead and read it.
All right. So to honor the academy, I'm just going to read bits and pieces of it. The United States Air Force sent a decommissioned Republic F-105 Thunder Chief, a THUD, to be placed on permanent display. But the dedication ceremony was scheduled for May 31st, the first day of graduation week festivities for the class of 1968. So four thuds from McConnell Air Force Base in Kansas would perform a flyby. So jumping ahead a little bit, they spotted the flight of four F-105s in a holding pattern. Then we saw them turn toward us and take up a diamond formation. We heard their J-75 turbojets scream as they flew northward over Mitchell Hall, the Air Gardens, and Vandenberg Hall. He says, though we were in formation, many cadets yelled and whistled at the passing jets, a breach of discipline our superiors were kind enough to overlook. We expected the formation to recede into the eastern horizon back to Kansas, but instead they turned south and took up tail spacing. They were lining up to make individual passes. And the author says, I could clearly see the lead aircraft turn north. This time, though, I could not hear its engine. I noticed a weird quality of light in the air around the thud. I didn't know what it meant, but a cadet in the next rank, an aeronautical major, obviously did. I heard him mutter, "Oh, shit," as he clapped his hands over his ears. He knew what was coming. The lead aircraft silently streaked by. Then the air around us seemed to shimmer, and we heard and felt the kaboom as the shock wave swept over us. The F-105 had broken the sound barrier just before passing over our heads. As the shock wore off, a few cadets began to clap and cheer, but that festive sound was quickly silenced by the kapow, kapow, kapow of windows shattering in Vandenberg Hall. So the general was purple with rage. The commandant was apoplectic. Only when we heard them summoning ambulances did we realize that people had been seriously injured by the flying glass. He said squadron was ordered into the dining hall, the south wall of which was floor-to-ceiling glass, or rather, it had been moments earlier. Everything, the floor, the tables, the plates, and yes, the food, was now covered with broken glass. We would not be having lunch that afternoon. We later learned that 15 people had been cut by flying glass. One officer was hospitalized for several weeks. So Matthews, the pilot, was grounded. His aircraft was inspected for defects. A board of inquiry determined that many were to blame for this incident. While they found no problem with Matthews' F-105, rumors persisted that its airspeed indicator system had a, quote, glitch that improperly indicated the true airspeed as it approached the speed of sound.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Matthews.
That's what I would have said.
I know. Matthews had broken numerous regulations, but his flight status was soon restored. The Vietnam War consumed F-105 pilots very quickly, and he was needed to train replacements. Now, this is sort of fun. News coverage of the incident was mostly unflattering to the Academy and the service. Fair enough. Nothing could justify so needlessly dangerous a stunt. But that demonstration of raw power made a deep and lasting impression on many of us young cadets. At a time when our nation was at war, it clearly reminded us of our purpose. We were training to be warriors, just like Matthews the pilot. One of my classmates, Scott Soddenberg, wrote of the flyby years later. This is a quote from him. In one split second, a 30-year Air Force career was born. I don't know how many other cadets were similarly affected, but all those windows broken may have been one of the best investments the Air Force made in recruitment and retention. So
great statement.
Yeah, it is great and probably very true. And there's more in the story. It's one of those. It's so well written, and it's just I think it's very, very cool.
It involves a really big engine making lots of noise. Of course, you like it.
Yes, of course I do.
Maverick.
Yeah. Launchpad, he chimed in. He said he was growing up in Colorado Springs at the time, and he remembers the local TV news coverage of this event. And he said that the TV reports were also worried about the chapel, which has a lot of glass. So thanks for sending that in. That came from Chris. It's a great read. It's a great read.
Let's hear it for all of those pilots that do really something stupid for the rest of us to enjoy. One year I was at Willow Grove during the air show, and I was actually in the hangar at our model club's exhibit, and we had an F-18 come introducing itself to the airfield in the middle of the Friday show. And he was lower than the hangar, lower than the tower, and the whole hangar shook. And the thing I remember most was after he touched ground and parked the aircraft, over the loudspeaker was, "To the pilot of the F-18 that just landed, please report to the commander, base commander in the hangar ASAP." Evidently, he was grounded and lost his wings. But it was pretty impressive to see an F-18 below hangar doors, fill a hangar's doors with noise, sound, and airplane. So
I love
it. Let's hear it for all those guys who were just a little too stupid, but we're thankful for them.
Yes, yes. All right. Another bit of feedback. This from James, who wrote just a comment about the oldest airfield. In the last episode, the comment was made about the oldest airfield being College Park Airfield, and this may well be correct. However, the oldest continuously operating military base in the world is generally acknowledged as Point Cook, now part of RAAF Williams, which was and still remains the birthplace of the RAF. It's also the site of the RAF Museum. It's a small but wonderful museum that exhibits the history of the RAF, including its close relationship with the USA, particularly with the U.S. Navy. He says Australia has always had more similar requirements to naval aviation rather than traditional United States Air Force equipment. He says, thanks for the great podcast. So thanks, James, for that. And then we'll finish off. This is a post by Denver in our Facebook page, which Peter Johnson kind of manages for all of us. We're really grateful for him for that effort. So this is a comment about last episode, episode 590. Did anyone answer your speed edition question? This is where we started off talking about airspeed versus ground speed. It ended up with the baseball thrown at 50 miles an hour inside a train traveling 100 miles an hour. So Denver says, the answer you gave for throwing a baseball 50 miles an hour on a train 100 miles an hour was rounded off. You can't just add 50 plus 100. Okay. To a person on the train, the baseball appears to be going 50 miles an hour. But as seen by a stationary observer on the ground, the baseball is going only 149.9995 miles per hour. If the baseball is thrown at 100 miles an hour, it adds up to about 199.99934 miles per hour, as seen by a stationary observer. Thus, of course, the speed of light plus 100 miles an hour adds up to exactly the speed of light. Rob's wondering what the hell we're talking about.
I was with it up until they got the 4999. How'd they know that? How did they come up with that? I would have thought it would be been an even number. I mean, I don't know.
Relativity.
Yeah, I was going to say, think about the Doppler effect you hear when a train goes by. This is kind of the light equivalent of Doppler effect in sound.
Time dilation. If you have two observers, if you have two clocks that are traveling with some velocity relative to each other.
Wait a minute, two clocks?
Yeah, like if you have a clock on the International Space Station and you have a clock on the ground, because there's a relative velocity, they don't read the same time.
Oh.
And that's time dilation. So it's a difference.
Fix the clock, right? No, yeah. I'm kidding.
The difference in elapsed time measured by two clocks, it can be either due to them having a velocity relative to each other or by their having a gravitational potential difference between their locations. That's why the woman astronaut who returned to Earth from the space station after being up there for a year, she actually aged a few milliseconds less than those of us who stayed on Earth.
That's why the twins aren't the same age anymore either.
That's right.
And wonder how she's going to use that extra time.
Yeah. So one question, the thing that kills me is after Denver went through this, about 45 years ago, I used to know this stuff, but it's been a while and I've forgotten my relativity training. An obvious question is, okay, so if there is that time difference, then what about with GPS, right? GPS is based on super accurate clocks being able to measure the difference in time between, you know, an electromagnetic signal, you know, the radio wave traveling to you at the speed of light, the difference between, you know, where you are here and 9 feet away from you, and it can tell the difference, right? It's all very accurate. So the GPS system actually takes time dilation into account and uses the formulas that describe this to make corrections when the GPS, you know, to make the GPS system work. Pretty cool.
Yeah. It automatically part of the triangulation system of GPS is the correction for time dilation because they are traveling faster than we are.
Right.
And you've got a lot of errors in GPS. You've got clock error where your clock may be off ever so slightly from where you believe it is. You got position error because we only know where those satellites are located within a few meters of where they actually are. So yeah. There's all kinds of errors that contribute to GPS.
It's almost incredible.
And for those listeners whose eyes have glazed over, I can tell you that in high school, when these kinds of mathematical discussions would begin, I would kind of go, ugh.
This is, Rob, if you listen.
They lost me at, here's an interesting question or something.
No, it's funny because I said that last week, Max, that suddenly I felt like I was back in fifth grade in word problems. If you have a train going X amount.
Exactly.
All right. So we'll enough of that. We'll stick to the aviation going forward. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. It's been fun. It's been different than usual with the format with a guest. Just the, you know, four of us kind of rambling on for the whole show.
Now, wait a minute. Rob's not guest. He's family. Okay, let's be clear about that.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's never lost host status.
Exactly.
So why are we giving him like all of this like additional credit, like being a guest?
No.
He's just a slob like the rest of us.
I'm very lonely here in Chicago on nights like this where I'm here all by myself and I just need extra attention.
All right, well, we're going to have you back again and again in the future, Rob.
This was fun. It really is cool to be able to see everybody.
It makes a difference.
Get older every year.
That's true too.
It brings new meaning to being able to clip your nails on the air.
Let's not go back to that.
All right. Blast from the past.
Okay, that's an old story, listeners. Yeah. We'll tell you some other time.
Find us at airplanegeeks.com. Show notes at airplanegeeks.com/591. That's the direct link. If you want to send us an email, you can write to us at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
The American Helicopter Museum, Wednesday through this week, Sunday. And if you're in the area, come see us. We're going to have a great presentation with the Tuskegee Airmen. But you can find me on Fridays on the UAV Digest with that guy, Max Flight. And, of course, you can find me on Twitter and Facebook and all those other places, and our Slack listener team, which, of course, you can do by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll send you a link, and you can join the conversation. And we have a lot of good conversations on that thing, and a lot of good stories come out of it that we don't get to talk to about the rest of the week, but it's a good thing. So find us there.
Great. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, people can sometimes find me down at Costco having a hot dog over the noon hour. So if you like,
meet me for lunch.
Come on down to the Mountain View Costco sometime. No, I'm usually found at aviationnewstalk.com. You can click on contact at the top of the page, shoot me an email, or you click on listener question and either record your favorite fun flying destination that you like to go to or a question for the show.
All right. And Rob Mark, where do people find you?
Well, they'll find me somewhere within the pages of Flying Magazine every month. Hopefully it's not where a reader calls in and says, you know, you made a mistake in that last story. It should have said, but certainly too at jetwine.com or at jetwine on Twitter and also at jetwine on Instagram. I think that's enough.
Great. You find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com and also at PaxXPodcast.com, talking about the passenger experience. So we'll ask all of you to please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Bye, everybody.
Nighty night.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.